Hello and welcome to this special live edition of EG's Future of Real Estate podcast. I'm Damien Wild, Editor-in-Chief of EG. And for the first time, you can see us in action rather than just listen. Yes, after being away for far too long, we're back and we're making up for lost time. This year had started so well, hadn't it? The confidence of transactors returned to the market and sentiment has been up. In the last couple of weeks, though, coronavirus has reminded us that we should never simply assume positive momentum will last. But back to Brexit. It suffocated the market last year, but some saw opportunity. Fiera Real Estate is one company in this space which struck while others stood still, perhaps. The property arm of investment giant Fiera Capital took a majority stake in Palmer Capital last April, having announced the acquisition would go ahead months earlier. Last November, it launched a £250 million value-add fund, seeing opportunity in logistics, offices and build-to-rent. And I'm pleased to be joined in the EG studio today by Fiera's Head of Global Real Estate, Peter Cuthbert, and Alex Price, UK Chief Executive. And over the next 30 minutes or so, we'll be talking about post-Brexit opportunities, where there's value in the market, and no doubt coronavirus and other risks too. Peter, can I start with you? You seem to have been remarkably untroubled by Brexit. Is that the case? Did you feel as confident going into 2018 and 2019 as perhaps you did in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, real estate is a long game, and we viewed the situation with Brexit as an intermittent or a blip on the radar in terms of the time frame that we look at real estate. And good value. So we felt that there was value in the UK. It was, or put it this way, the market was being undervalued. And the nature of the business of Alex's team at Palmer and the type of capital they represented, we felt was quite captive and sticky. And we've just felt it was an opportune time to enter that market. 67 million people represent a market. I think it's, Alex may correct me if I'm wrong, but growing to well over 70 over the next 10 years, and we're in the shelter business. And as long as there's growth, we're doing well. So that's how we view the market.
And presumably you looked around the world at that time and thought the UK is interesting.
Yeah, in terms of our plan, we've established a fully developed investment management business in Canada, all sectors, all geographies, full range of strategies. Our intent now to serve our capital base, our investor base, is to expand into the major developed markets around the world. Obviously, the UK is one of the biggest. I think transaction volume-wise, we'd be in pound sterling. We probably did about 25 billion last year in trade, and I think the UK would have been closer to 60 plus billion. And then the US is obviously the monster in that field at 250. So our targets would be those markets first. So UK, Europe. And the U.S. would be following on shortly. So we also have a debt and credit, stress debt and credit shop in Asia as well. So the idea is to be able to serve our investor clients globally and move money cross-border.
Okay, thank you. And Alex, shall we deal with coronavirus? I've moved the hand sanitizer off the table, which was there. I think we've all had made sure we're using that. But you'd have gone into 2020, presumably, thinking we're back on an even keel. You know, the election out the way, certainty back in the market, certainty to transact, I think, was a phrase that first cropped up in Savills' results. But now, coronavirus, how do you think that might impact over the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think the first thing is it changes, you know, month on month, week on week, and maybe even day on day as we go forward. And the effect, I think we're just starting to see in the UK, the effect's got two real things. One is a human effect and a human cost and the tragic loss of life yesterday of the first victim. But there's also going to be an economic impact in what goes on here. And that impact will take a while to ripple through the UK. You can see it in the markets. We had that initial fall off in equity markets, a bit of a recovery as people thought, is it not going to be that bad? And then today the markets have gone down again. So I think actually there's going to be three impacts or to every business. One is how do you run your business? What's your policy for people in the office? How do you protect people? The second one is what do you allow people to do in terms of travel? And thirdly, how are you planning to run a business if you're not allowed to travel, for example, into your office? So I think everybody at the moment is probably doing what we're doing, which is having put in place some very practical steps last week to deal with that containment phase, hand sanitizers you've got, we've got, travel policies that have amended. That's now moving on, I think, to companies starting to a little bit more into what would they do in the coming months. I think the big question, though, is what does it do in the coming years? SARS didn't have a huge impact. I guess that's a recent example. But this might just do things like accelerate the trend to remote working. You know, as we all go through our plans now to say, how do we work remotely, not just for individuals, but for organizations, maybe that sticks. And maybe that does help that trend towards more flexible working. So in the short term, I think there's going to be a lot of upheaval. I think there's going to be some tragic human consequences here. In the longer term, I suspect that we will move forward as a world, and actually there may be some long-term trends that change as a result of this.
And in the jobs that you do, in the jobs that we do, I think most people are comfortable with working at home periodically, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes pre-planned. But we could be talking about an extended period, and presumably that's what could accelerate that change.
Yeah, and I think in a way, in an office-based environment, you're one of the easiest roles to work remotely. But we have to remember lots of people are doctors, dentists, physios, are people working in warehouses, people working in factories. Those roles are not so easy to work remotely. So that's why I think there will be an economic effect of what goes on. Even if you, me, Peter can all do this simply, lots of people can't.
Okay, and Peter, is this are these provisions a UK phenomenon, or is it happening back home as well?
No, I'd say I think in North America we're a little bit behind in terms of the impact. So we have cases now in Canada for sure, and we're evaluating all of our business practices along the lines Alex mentioned. But I think to his point about how this could potentially have a change on how we think about work and how we affect work in the workplace. I think more importantly, it may change the way we use space, which is our business. So we'll be watching this trend and some of the developments with a mind to the future as to, is this a proof of concept, and does this start to shift the way in which people will use the built form? And then how do we respond to that?
How might it change the way we use space?
Well, I think if you have more people working remotely and we're using more technology, there's impacts on all of the supply chain, the transportation systems, and the type and dispersion of space that we work, or the roofs that we work under. Under all is the land, so and everybody needs shelter. It's just a question of what type of shelter is going to be appropriate for a new way of operating and moving about in the economy and in the community.
Okay, thank you, Alex.
I just add, and there are things which we in the real estate profession should be thinking about doing. So we are engaging this week with our property managers and asking them to engage with the underlying tenants to make sure that we are seen to care about this. It's quite easy as businesses to think about our employees, but in real estate we've got customers. So we need to think about those as well, which is something we're not really used to doing, particularly when we're trying to figure it out for ourselves.
So it could trigger that change as well.
And I think it is helping
more customer centric, using space
about,
differently.
Yeah, how do we do what we do differently? Because we're going to have to be different to overcome potentially changes in the next weeks, months. The second thing, of course, is all of the businesses that we are backing by leasing them space. Those businesses are going to have to look at their own revenue and costs, because it will have an impact. We saw Flybe going bankrupt a couple of days ago, or going to administration a couple of days ago. That happened pretty quickly, which shows me that business may not have had a sustainable business model, and financially may have been quite fragile as a result of debt that it had in it. And so we need to look at all of our customers and make sure that the credit risk we're taking is commensurate to the return we're getting.
This is an event. It probably has a start and a finish to it, hopefully. That's what we would expect. But I think it turns the mind toward how do you future-proof your businesses, because this won't be the last of these types of events. And
this wouldn't have been on your risk schedule for 2020 a few months ago.
Not this type of risk, right? This is something new to think about and respond to. And so the work that goes on today will bear fruit in the future as well, in terms of how we manage and take care of each other and take care of our businesses and work our way through what I think will just be a more volatile business environment generally going forward.
And, as well as the medium term, the longer term implications. A question that came in earlier was, do you think that coronavirus will now impact on the Boris bounce we have seen since the general election and Brexit Day on the 31st of January? And perhaps more specifically, will vendors hold off from putting assets up for sale with overseas investors not able to travel to the UK and vice versa, therefore limiting opportunities this year?
I think that is almost inevitable. When you look at what we do, most people, as I said, in office environments can work remotely. So we can still do a lot of what we do. And I'd actually add, we can also visit properties. We could drive there in our car, have a look around, but actually doing the extra things, the personal interaction, the inspections within the property, these are things that may well get limited, as well as travel for international investors. So my suspicion is that this will cause a pause in the market, particularly if we do go down a phase where the government restricts travel within the UK as well as internationally. Who knows whether that'll happen or not, but if it does, it will have an effect.
I think what's interesting about that, Alex, is because that was a question focused on what happens for the UK. All of the countries in the Western world and across the world are going to be dealing with the same issues, and you're going to have supply chain disruption all over the place. So it won't be unique to the UK. It'll be an international phenomenon.
Okay, I'm sure we'll come back to this as questions come in. But just moving on to some of the things that I did want to cover, and I said back to Brexit in the intro. Let's go back to Brexit now. And I should say that EG and Fiera partnered recently on a video looking at post-Brexit opportunities in the UK. And I just wonder, Alex, what are the areas at a headline level, and then we'll go into them in more detail, that you think are worthy of focus?
So three areas. One, population-related assets. Two, efficient energy sensitive and technology enabled buildings. Three, working with corporates to help them figure out their supply chain. So what that means, the population, as Peter said today, 67 million people. The ONS forecasts say there's 71.5 million people in 9.5 years time. They're gonna need somewhere to live. We're short of houses already. We're short of capability to build houses. So we are huge fans post-Brexit of focusing on land, focusing on delivering housing, focusing on PRS or built to rent, focusing on care homes. We think anything that's population related, that works well. Secondly, the buildings we're building or the buildings we're occupying.
So just before we move on to that second one, that on the residential piece, and the there'll be a slide coming up on the screen now, just showing from the video, actually showing how trends in tenure are changing as well. And, you know, our home used to be a castle that we owned. We're moving. It's becoming a castle we rent, perhaps.
And there's two trends that are happening there. One is affordability. The second is lifestyle. Doing the second one first, people are renting more days. Just you know, I don't know about you, but I don't buy DVDs. I now just stream the movie I want to watch it from whichever service provider. That's a cultural shift. My mother-in-law doesn't own a car anymore. She just rents one when she needs it for the day. That's a cultural shift. People are getting much used to renting rather than owning. Secondly, houses today on average are 8 times average salary is the cost of a house. That's pretty unaffordable. And when you combine that with reduced access to mortgages, because after the 2008, there's been much greater regulation put in there, people aren't buying houses because they don't want them. They're buying them because they can't afford them. They're renting not because they want to rent, because they have to rent. So we think that trend will continue. But behind it, there's a growing population.
Okay, and you're about to move on.
So secondly, what we found is customers want better buildings, better quality buildings. So we built in Bristol a building in 2008, which we leased for about £26 a foot. We've just started on site and have announced a lease of a building in Bristol about 50 metres along the street, about the same size, and the rent there is £36 a foot. So everybody says to me, that's, you know, that's a big gross, that's an almost 35% increase in rents. When you add the service charge, though, the service charge has gone from £10 to £6. So actually, the net growth, adding the service charge, is about 15-20%. The key difference is the first building in 2008 was space plan 1 person for every 12 square metres. The new one is 1 per 8 square metres. So to our customers, per employee, they're actually saving about 25-30%. So for them, it makes sense to go to a new building. So we think post-Brexit, That is where the focus will be in offices. I'm building better quality, much more densely occupied, much better buildings for our customers.
And a greater assumption that people will work from home.
Yeah, and part of the way you do that exactly is people work from home, but you need to be able to facilitate that surge should everybody come in. So you do need more loos and more lifts, but actually you can probably manage it through more flexible working environment. A better quality, but flexible working environment. And the third thing, almost regardless of where Boris takes us on Brexit, the supply chain in the UK will change. To my mind, that's almost a given. Services may or may not be included in the trade deal. We may or may not have some certainty from equivalence, but equivalence, I think, is a three-month rolling agreement where the European Union can pull us out of that services. So actually, we're going to have to look very deeply at where our commercial real estate infrastructure is. And someone is going to have to help those corporates replan that infrastructure, those buildings, those offices, the warehouses, the industrial units. So we think that is where there will be a huge opportunity post-Brexit.
Okay, and just on the EU point and the relationship there, is there, again, a question that came in earlier, is there an ideal trade relationship with the EU that would benefit the property industry, or is it largely incidental?
I think in a way you're better to look at it from the other end of the telescope. The further away we go from where we are today, the more risks there are in that change. There is opportunity in every risk, but there is more risk. So as a market, the closer aligned we stay on goods and services, the easier it will be for us to continue our real estate market as we have. If, though, for political reasons, we change and we, for example, don't include services within the agreement, or we have trade agreements that have tariffs, then that will create an opportunity.
Okay, thank you. And Peter, just going back to Alex's first point there around residential, you know, the UK build-to-rent market is always talked about as being in early stages and thus being behind the rest of the world, particularly North America. Where might we expect it to be in 2 or 3 years' time?
For North America?
For the UK. Other markets have developed, where are we headed?
Yeah, I think the fundamentals are moving to support, as Alice has just explained, to support additional rental. It's becoming unaffordable. Similar trends are occurring in the North American cities. Anyway, we've always had rental housing, but it's actually accelerating. The amount of rental stock is increasing. Number of renters are increasing for the exact same reasons that it's happening in London. It's just not affordable. People who have jobs that are perfectly sound, stable jobs, paramedics, healthcare workers, people like that, that might have sort of a fixed upside to what they would make, are always going to be able to afford to pay for shelter. They just can't own it anymore. So that rental, I think globally, that rental demand will continue to rise. And you'll have more people working, living in rental space.
Okay, going back to the investment market more broadly, and we're just going to pull up a slide now, again from the video. We're leaning on that video heavily for this. I just wonder, Peter, what the view of the rest of the world of the UK at the moment is. CBRE research, as the slide shows, CBRE research suggests that the UK has missed out on as much as 90 billion euros of real estate investment since the referendum. Yet, as another slide shows, the UK economy could outgrow France and Germany in the year or years ahead. Is it about to get coronavirus willing, very competitive from an international investment point of view?
It's interesting from our standpoint. We didn't think the market ever really went away. We felt it took a pause while people worked out what Brexit was all about. I find these sort of geopolitical events are moments in time that disrupt or impact cycles, and it impacted Great Britain, I'll call it in the context of real estate, in the short term. But once
you're very much more sanguine than many people I speak to, I should say.
I possibly am, yeah. But I think maybe I look in a longer view, but ultimately the capital figures it out. Ultimately, goods have to move from raw materials through manufacturing to end users. And the borders are political instruments, and they put friction into the system, but ultimately the capital and the goods figure it out. Britain is a very big market. It's not going away people aren't leaving. I think, Alex, you mentioned that for every inbound migrant that used to come out of Europe, there's almost an equal number coming from elsewhere around the world, so it continues to grow. So we felt pretty confident. Another Canadian outfit, Michael Turner, head of Oxford Properties, was just recently quoted. He's saying they sort of made a call that they were going to sell out of Britain, so they say sold down. He said now they're going to buy back in, and he's thinking that maybe they shouldn't have moved in the first place. So he was quoted saying that. I think real estate's a long investment. It's a fundamental requirement. Effectively, all we do is shelter the economy. So as long as there's people eating, living, working, breathing, and buying things in that economy, we're okay. Yeah.
Okay. And will your relaxed manner, your long-term view be maintained if, as we get to the end of the year, and that that deal with the EU starts to look a bit more fragile? Do you see windows shutting, or will you still be looking at 3, 5, 10 years ahead?
Yeah, no, I think you always have to respond to the short term and prepare for some of that pain and suffering that could occur. I think what we've observed so far is while the UK didn't grow as fast as perhaps Europe did, we didn't see people emptying out of buildings or going out of business in a big way or any of those sorts of changes. So that's encouraging and indicates some stability and really a pause in the market as opposed to a cyclical adjustment. If things don't go as well as everybody expects at the end of the year, I expect we'll have a few quarters of turmoil again as everybody figures out what the rules are. For real estate, the worst point in time is when you don't have clarity on what the rules are and how the system works. And that's where we're at. And I think that's why you had a pause. We're not worried about doing the business. We just want to know what the rules are and the framework within which we're operating. As soon as that becomes clear, everybody resets and figures it out and we move on again. So I'm not speaking for the rest of the world, though. That's me, personally. So,
Alex?
I'd add, over the last decade, if you look at, for example, office construction, using the JLL numbers, we've seen construction new starts 2008, 13 billion. Last year, 6 billion. So we've more than halved the amount of offices that we're building. Now, you can argue that we've got more dense offices, so we need less of them. But against that, we've got a growing workforce, so we need more of them. So we're probably seeing an undersupply of offices. And when I say that, because you look at vacancy rates in Bristol, which we talked about earlier, on the last 10 years, on average 8%, right now it's at 4%. There's 3 years' supply of office stock there. Even more exacerbated in Leeds, where we've just bought a building to develop out with our partner Opus North, 8% average vacancy. Today it stands at 5%, but only 1 year's supply. So actually we're going to see a lot of shocks. We're going to see a lot of economic noise. We're going to see issues with Brexit. And you're right. Almost certainly we're not going to get there by the end of the year. And on the journey, there's going to be lots of people shouting from the rooftops about how difficult it all is. But fundamentally, what Brexit has done, and certainly in the last few years, has reduced supply. It hasn't changed demand as much. It's just reduced supply. So for us, we fundamentally believe in things like the office sector and across the UK regional cities.
Okay, and government can help. It doesn't always help, but it can help. And one question that's come in is, what steps would property like to see taken in next week's budget to support the longer term fundamentals of the market?
Well, so I'm going to give you one is business rates, which is a common one. I know and I appreciate that they gave some business rate relief to pubs at the beginning of February. That's something that myself,
that personally
my,
helpful?
Myself and my friends are very grateful okay. for. Thank you. But that's about a £13,000 impact to pubs. Actually, it's got to be looked at much more broadly than that. The transitional rate relief arrangements, which basically slow the rises but also slow the falls in rates if your rateable value goes up or down, work as an anchor towards rebasing the cost of the high street. So on the way down, as we are in the high street, actually those rates are staying higher than maybe they should be if it was correcting to market levels. So business rates is something I think that's very easy to look at.
It's fallen on deaf ears for so long. It must be more hope than expectation.
Yeah. You didn't ask me what I expected to happen. You asked me what I thought should happen. I think secondly, you look at infrastructure investment. They're talking about delaying the infrastructure announcement from the budget. They've also said that by in the next 20 years, we want to have a net zero carbon economy. I've seen estimates that say that's going to cost $100 billion per annum for 20 years. So I'd like to see in the budget a plan to deliver the money that's required to deliver a net zero carbon environment. Because if we haven't got the money, we ain't going to get there on the plan. In November, we'll have the conference in Glasgow, COP26. Let's see where that goes. But I worry still that there's too much window dressing and not enough actual delivery of the capital that's needed. I also expect to see not just an increase in the affordable housing scheme, which is the government put $9 billion into that over recent years, but a change from Help to Buy to what they're going to call First Home Scheme, which, as I read it, seems to be a 30% discount if it's a first house. I haven't yet figured out who's paying for that discount, and I haven't yet figured out how this will work through. But we're quite clear that the problem is not in reducing the house price. The problem is in supplying the houses in the first place. If you increase the supply, and the government's target of 300,000 has been missed in every year for the last decade or more, if you increase the supply through the planning system, chances are pricing would be less of an issue because we'd have more supply to meet that demand. So I suspect we're going to see some things like, say, first home, affordable housing scheme, some green infrastructure investment, nothing on business rates, probably something on entrepreneurs relief because that's a vote winner. But actually, I think they need to be planning much longer term.
Okay, and Peter, on sustainability and the way it's being addressed here, do you look at the UK and think they're on the front foot or on the back foot?
From a North American context, I would say that Europe and the UK were leading in that space, particularly in the real estate area, and we are catching up now. It's a fundamental change in mindset and attitude, and it has really come home, I would say, in the last 2 years, really has seen significant change. And I think our compatriots are realizing that we're a place in the economy where we can be massively impactful in a positive way on things like carbon reduction and looking towards net zero targets. The building industry is a significant contributor. So it's a fundamental change. And if you don't address it, you'll miss out. It's table stakes today.
But I think, Damon, you and I have talked a lot over the years at land aid meetings over how many years it's been. What I'm seeing more and more is people waking up and realizing that social inequality and climate change are two issues that they can't walk by on the other side of the street from. And that actually, I think, is a really good thing, because in real estate, as Peter just said, we account for about 35% of the energy that's used and about 40% of the carbon emissions in the broader sense of real estate. Also, in a democracy, if you have social inequality where very few own the assets and the majority don't, then it creates social unrest and upheaval. So I think if I'm looking at all of this sustainability, the best thing is to raise awareness that these are two issues, climate change, social inequality, that we have to address. We are recruiting a full-time person into our business. We're a small business, but a full-time person into our London team to deal with this, with the ESG aspect of what we do, because it's really, really important to us, not just for talking to clients about what we do, but actually for changing the way we behave and helping others change.
We're working to embed it into our culture fully. So we're engaging our team directly in these causes and actually supporting them in their endeavors outside of our business as well. And the mindset is that's what's required to change, make positive change and change the mindset. People putting something into the system, not trying to take it out all the time.
I think you're right. I think that sense of purpose is being embraced sincerely, mostly, perhaps, catching up in a few other cases and, perhaps a bit of purpose washing in a few. But I think real estate is changing very much for the better. And I think the other area where there's change, and time as ever is against us, and I do want to make sure we cover tech, and a slide will pop up on the screen now, which I think really hammers home a point that, tech is changing real estate. And from a landlord point of view, that there is an advantage in leasing a connected building. But I guess more broadly, Alex, just a few comments on the role that tech plays and how far up your list of priorities and real estate's priorities generally is.
So we're a small team, but we've had a full-time technologist, for want of a better expression, within our business for the last 3 years. that person's predominant responsibility is to organize the data that's flowing around our business, to standardize it, which actually takes a long time to do because, you know, we all call a building a different name, but in, from a technology point of view, you need to have the same name in your database. And then we're now moving through having organized that, we're starting to use that data to give ourselves better access to information and decision-making. We've chosen not to go down a bespoking route. We've just bought off the shelf and done minor tweaks to use it. We've chosen to make our tech accessible so that everybody understands what it is rather than three PhDs locked away in a back room. And we're taking the technology that we're using in our business to better assess and assimilate data to produce outputs that we can then pass to our investors and to our customers in the buildings.
And you're suggesting there, if I'm understanding you correctly, that tech and data are synonymous in real estate.
I think technology is just a word that says how you do something. So to my mind, it's about digitization of your business to allow it to scale. And if you haven't digitized your business, you won't be able to access the technology that's coming through from machine learning and beyond. So actually, technology is almost the wrong word. To my mind, it's digitization, and having a data-centric business is the right way of looking at it.
And your eyebrows rose slightly when I referred to purpose washing on the parts yeah. of some people. Do you think there's a little bit of that in the tech and the data space as well?
Yeah, there is. There's quite a bit of people looking at technology as a lifeboat that they just jump into and it can sail them to a safer shore. I don't think that is the case. I think you really need to understand what you want to achieve. You need to bring in-house into your team people who understand it far more than you do, and you need to execute, and you need to be relentless about continuing to execute. It's very easy just to wave the badge or wave the flag and think that you've dealt with the problem.
Okay, and again, Peter, where does the UK stand in a sort of global hierarchy?
In terms of application of technology
Absolutely,
in buildings,
yeah.
I think they're at a leading edge. I shouldn't say that. Compared to Canada, I think we're a little bit behind. We're a smaller market and catching up in some ways. North American-wide, though, I think technology is at the front edge of everything that's happening now. But when I think about technology is a tool that we use to solve problems. And I think if we try to start with the problem first, and then use the right technology to resolve that issue. But when it comes to, so where's the UK? I think they're well advanced in this, and new buildings are coming through. I think LEED, I forget what the UK, BREEAM, LEED are now sort of the standard for any new building you have to follow. And I think the greatest challenge we're going to have, location will always be the driver of value, but the biggest challenge we have, and it runs through all of society, is the pace of change. So our buildings are becoming functionally obsolete much more quickly than they used to be. So you have to invest in the technologies. You need to put the sensors on the systems to monitor your energy output. You can monetize things like conference rooms by having sensors and being able to put your meeting room out when it's not used to the market where somebody else can use it and create more efficiencies in the use of space. So it's just... again, table stakes for being successful in the business and adapting to the new world.
And Peter, we've learnt how relaxed you are about some of these blips that are on the horizon or in the middle of. When you look at those longer term impactful changes like sustainability, like purpose, ESG more widely, and tech, how do you rank those, or are they all coalescing?
I think they're actually coalescing. I think they're connected in every way. They cross over amongst each other, and you have to consider all of them. And I think, you know, maybe I seem relaxed about all of this. To me, this sort of evolution has been going on forever, since the dawn of time, and it's always an opportunity. Thoughtful, strategic businesses, business leaders, entrepreneurs, figure these things out, and we move forward, and we'll continue to do so. So maybe that's why I'm relaxed about it. Is we know it's coming, we know what it looks like, and we're going to continue to solve for the solutions and deliver what the market requires. But I think, in a broad way, one of the things technology can do for us is move us along the path of being less impactful on the planet, which I think we all agree now, is something that has to be done. So I see technology evolving the use of space and the efficiency in space so that it's much less impactful on the planet.
Okay, that's a good note to end on. We're out of time, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you for your questions as well. Thank you to Alex and Peter as well. We're going to apply hand sanitizer now and wrap up and leave you watching the video on post-Brexit opportunities.